from the Watch Your Step studios of WDIY FM in Bethlehem, PA. It is time for another goose egg of an hour, a chemical-free horticultural hygiene to bet your garden. Canada geese and their prodigious poop have always been a nuisance in human health threat. Now add avian flu to the list of diseases they can disperse. I'm Mike McGrath, and on today's show, we'll discuss a unique business that specializes in getting them gone. Plus, how to handle your spring bulbs, your repeat bloom, and your fabulous phone call questions, comments, tips, tricks, suggestions, and categorically correct configuration. So stay right where you are, cats and kittens. It's all coming up like you stepping on nice, clean grass instead of you know what.
WDIY has been broadcasting in the Lehigh Valley and beyond for 30 years, providing news.
These planes were hijacked.
The Bethlehem Steel Corporation will end its steelmaking production in Bethlehem.
We hope that you enjoyed hearing from the Dalai Lama.
Local public affairs.
As I say, it's a race of interest.
What we're experiencing today will later on be studied.
And music.
My name is Janice Ian.
Our guest, Lake Street Dive.
In a few minutes, we're going to be talking to Petey Yarrow from Peter, Paul, and Mary.
WDIY, since 1995.
From the mysterious studios of WDIY-FM in Bethlehem, PA, it is time for another perplexing plant hour of chemical-free horticultural hijinks, you bet your garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and in this week's edition of In the News, we discuss the mysterious disappearance of a plant from the most famous house in America, which we are calling, Where, Oh, Where Did the Oval Office Ivy Go? Now you see it, now you don't. As reported by the Washington Post's Maura Judkis, people have recently noticed a change in the nation's Oval Office. The so-called Swedish ivy plant that had become a fixture on the fireplace mantle since at least the time of Gerald Ford's presidency was gone, replaced by seven gold-colored objects that some people assumed to be President Trump's golf trophies. That part, at least, is not true. The golden artifacts are from an extensive White House collection of such decorative material. One is an 1815 French bronze basket gifted to then-President Nixon in 1973. Two are tableware from the Monroe administration, acquired in 1817, shortly after the British burned the White House. And the other two objects are from the Eisenhower administration. As reported simultaneously in Mother Jones and on Wikipedia, President Clinton famously told the story that the ivy was gifted to President John F. Kennedy in 1961 by the then Irish ambassador to the United States. But photographs clearly show that the president instead received a container of shamrocks. No one knows for sure exactly when the ivy landed on the mantle, but the first dated photo of it appears during the Gerald Ford administration. And from that point on, it was a constant. The Post recounts that the plant was, quote, bushy and unkempt under Jimmy Carter, was pruned back during the administrations of Ronald Reagan and George H.W. Bush, is featured prominently in Bill Clinton's official presidential portrait, and was split into, quote, three neat topiary-like shrubs for George W. Bush. Under President Obama, it became a, quote, wide sprawling hedge that was cut down to two smaller plants during Donald Trump's first term and then grew longer and wider again under Joe Biden. Quote the Post, that plant filtered the air breathed by Nelson Mandela, Pope John Paul II, Margaret Thatcher, and Whitney Houston. It was the first thing the president saw when he looked across the room from the Resolute desk. But it was never Swedish, and it was never a true member of the Ivy family. Native to South Africa, it's a variegated, non-clinging impersonator that has become a popular houseplant in America, especially in hanging baskets. Notes Wiki, it does well in indirect light, likes to stay moist, responds well to pruning, and can easily be rooted from cuttings, which many White House staffers have done over the decades, taking cuttings as souvenirs of their time as White House aides and such, and then making cuttings of those cuttings for friends. Reading between the lines, I'll guesstimate that there are hundreds of healthy descendants in homes across the nation, perhaps thousands. But this army of clones won't be needed for the Ivy's eventual return. Following a fierce bout of investigative reporting, the Post was able to quote a confidential source who revealed that the Ivy has been relocated to a greenhouse on the White House grounds where backup versions have long resided out of the public eye.
WDIY presents a selection of award-winning podcasts that air weeknights from 6 to 7 p.m. Listen to important conversations regarding art, science, business, health, and more here in the Lehigh Valley and beyond. Check our website for new topics and archived programs. WDIY podcasts are on 88.1 FM, streaming at wdiy.org, on the app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to another thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden. From the studios of WDIY FM in Bethlehem, PA, I am your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up in just a little bit, are your spring bulb beds getting crowded and you're wondering how and if and when you should divide them up? What about people who live in climates that are too warm to grow tulips but still want to do it? Is there a trick they can pull? We'll tell you all about it and more after another of your fabulous phone calls at 610-694-8100. Paula, welcome back to You Bet Your Garden.
Well, thank you, Mike.
I have to acknowledge and admit, I've talked about having dyslexia a lot over the years, and some people think I'm kidding around, but no, I've had it all my life. I was like 8 or 9 years old before I could make a 5, which I've always written backwards until a teacher taught me, and you sent us an email about liverwort in your garden. And for some reason, I fixated on a totally different plant called mugwort and just wasted everybody's time during a taping session. But I know what I'm doing now. Do I? So let's start at the basics because people didn't hear what we had to toss last time. You're in Alaska?
Yeah, I live in Southeast Alaska, which is right alongside of British Columbia. We have a maritime climate. It's a temperate rainforest. We get 90 to 100 inches of rain a year, and it never gets warm. It never gets cold. It's just moderate all the time, just really wet. So I have several garden boxes, raised beds. They're foot high and 4 by 14 feet, and it helps raise the soil temperature and improves drainage. But the problem is that one of the boxes that I have strawberries in, and I've got 4 or 5 with strawberries, is it's getting overrun with liverwort. And I've been trying to pick it off, and it just keeps coming back, and now it's just getting worse. I don't know what to do with it.
Do you call them islands? What do you call them? Because you have to take the ferry or an airplane or a boat to get from one area to the other.
Lloyd, I live on an island. It's about 30 miles long. There's no roads off the island, and pretty much all the communities in the southeast are roadless. Juneau's on the mainland, but there's no road out of there, so they're pretty much isolated, too.
What you have, liverwort, is kind of a crossover, quote-unquote, plant. It's more like a moss. It's a very weird plant, and it got its name from something called the Doctrine of Similars way back when they were first categorizing plants. If a plant looked like something in your body, the leaves of most varieties of liverwort look like your liver. That was meant as a sign from nature that you should use this plant for liver ailments, which is totally false, of course. But the Doctrine of Similars is what evolved into homeopathy, which is still active today. So your problem is not so much the plant, but that it's intertwined with strawberries, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, how many raised beds do you have?
Probably 10 boxes.
And is the liverwort confined to one?
Yes, just one, thank goodness.
Oh, that shouldn't be bad. And what you're growing in there is strawberries.
Right.
Now, you should be able to grow great strawberries. I know I'm very familiar with Southeast Alaska and the growing conditions. You can grow cabbages the size of a diesel truck, for instance. But most seasons, if not all, you need some sort of structure to get ripe tomatoes and peppers and things like that. But cool season crops, they go wild where you are. And in this case, the fact that you have strawberries makes this not a difficult task. How many years old are the strawberries?
Oh, I replaced them about 2 years ago.
Okay, good, good. Do they, when they send out, quote, daughters, do you do anything with those plants branching off from the mother plant?
Sometimes I'll take those and fill them in places where I don't have any, but I'm not pulling anything out of that box to put in other boxes because I don't want to spread the liverwort.
Oh, no, no. Well, it's not a really invasive, God, I almost hesitate to call it a plant. I'll call it a thing or something like that because it's much more closely related to a moss, which means, of course, in your climate, it is going to thrive. It's in liverwort heaven. So what I suggest you do is reach down into the soil and you have a whole bunch of containers, and those strawberry plants should have grown nicely, but they should still be nicely isolated from each other. So just gently pull them out. I would add pull them out of moist soil, but that's cruel to say to somebody in Southeast Alaska. And the fact that the soil is moist, they'll come out very easily. Pot them up into any kind of containers you can find. This is just temporary. Growing them in containers would be a lot of fun. If you got an old bench or a picnic table, you can put the pots up on there, make the strawberries easier to get at and harder for your slugs who don't have to work very hard. And then you can literally just pull out the liverwort. Its mossy structure means that many types of its cousin plants don't have actual roots. Like moss, true moss, it'll grow on rocks or wood or something like that. Liverwort is kind of a hybrid in the world of horticulture in that it does have weak rhizomes. So what I want you to do is get those strawberries out of there and pot them up into separate containers right away. Then pull up the liverwort by hand. If it really is covering the whole thing, you should be able to almost roll it up like a carpet. And then just keep an eye on that bed. You don't have to. Don't dig in it. Don't disturb the soil any more than you have to. And keep an eye on it for a month. If no new liverwort material appears, then you're golden. It's done with. But if you think those rhizomes still have enough strength to produce new plants, cover that raised bed. And is there room to put a piece of plastic over top, or is the soil above the top of the beds?
No, I can put plastic over it.
Okay. 2 or 3 mil clear plastic and just stretch it over top of the bed. Use rocks or bricks to hold it down on the side. And then when you're really long summer days, they should actually be right around the corner, right? Because I was there in April and it didn't get dark till 10 p.m.
Yep, pretty soon.
Yeah, so that's your best chance. You really can't solarize soil in Southeast Alaska or any part of Alaska, but this should be enough. It's a very weak rhizome. It's like a quarter of a root system. So just by isolating it, covering it with plastic, and the plastic will keep rain out, which is good because this thing thrives on moisture. And otherwise, you're going to be out there for a week nonstop with a hairdryer. But I think you can move the strawberries, get rid of the liverwort, and then in my world, I would plant something different in that bed and move the strawberries someplace else. And again, I got slugs too. So little copper flashing or hot glue some pennies around the top of your containers, and you'll eat all the strawberries instead of your enormous slugs.
Hmm, okay. I'll give that a try.
Yeah, and I know you have slug problems. One of the easiest ways to kind of foil them is to get copper flashing, you know, like you would do around a chimney on a roof. And be careful because it can be very sharp. But just at the top of your raised beds, put a barrier of copper and slugs can't cross over it.
That's what I use. It's very effective.
Yeah, it's great. If you go out at night, you can see them get electrified. They give off a little shock. It's great.
If they're already in the bed, I use a spray of ammonia and water.
I would not use ammonia. If anything, you know, the old salt shaker is a great cure, and it's very satisfying to see them shrivel up. You know, you only have to get like 1 grain of salt on them and they're doomed. And if, for instance, you're from Philly like I am, you can stand there and taunt them as they're shrinking like the Wicked Witch. And you don't have to worry about salt because your excessive rainfall will keep rinsing it out. I don't like ammonia. I certainly don't like bleach. I wouldn't use vinegar because it's an herbicide. But this might be a case for restrained use of salt being the most effective. You don't want to pick them up and throw them. That gets old real fast.
No.
Okay?
Okay.
I hope I redeemed myself.
Thank you.
All right. My pleasure. Thank you. Good luck. Well, it's time for me to take a little break and warn everybody out there that the time is getting close for me to give a free lecture at the Allentown Public Library on Tuesday, April 15th at 6 p.m. I'll answer your garden questions, sign my gardening books, and tell lots of tall tales. That's Tuesday evening, April 15th at 6 p.m. But don't go circling the date on your day timer just yet, because we'll be right back to talk about getting rid of non-migrating geese and take more of your non-migrating phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from the studios of WDIY-FM in Bethlehem, PA.
For the past 3 decades, WDIY has sustained itself through direct contributions from listeners. Our model is simple. The people who listen to the service are the ones who support the service. As WDIY celebrates its landmark 30th anniversary, we invite you to join us as a WDIY member by making a membership gift today. This is something you could do right now to make a meaningful difference in your community. Call 610-694-8100 extension 4 or online at wdiy.org.
Welcome back to another thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden from the studios of WDIY-FM in Bethlehem, PA. I am your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, are your spring bulb beds getting a little crowded and you're wondering about dividing them and splitting them and sharing them around? Or do you live in a region where it's theoretically too hot to grow tulips, but you know there's a trick that'll allow you to do it? We're going to cover those topics and basic spring bulb care later on in the show. But right now it is time to welcome our special guest, Bob Young, who is the founder and CEO of a company called Geese Chasers. It is a company devoted to making sure Canada geese do not get too comfortable in a place where they can cause problems. Bob, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Oh, well, thank you, Michael. I'm thrilled to be here, and it's an honor to be on your show. And we are in the midst of our busy season right now, so I'm here to answer any and all questions you may have.
Okay, well, we want to talk about your company a little bit, but first, let's lay down the basics. You and I know there's lots of different kinds of geese, but for our intents and purposes, there are Canada geese that migrate and Canada geese that are called residents who no longer migrate. And yes, I'm guessing it's the resident geese who've decided to move into a neighborhood and stay there that are your biggest challenge.
Yes. The resident geese are the ones that are the big problems. They're the ones that are nesting, roosting, feeding, building nests, raising their families year after year on certain properties. They typically come back to the same property if they have a successful clutch the year prior and will build another nest close to where they were previously.
And although they may travel a little bit, they don't migrate in the true sense of the word like monarch butterflies.
No, their migratory patterns, the resident geese have been studied for years, and the last study I saw years ago was that their migratory patterns in the Mid-Atlantic Fly Zone, which we sit here in New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Virginia, all along the Mid-Atlantic states, has been estimated at less than 20 miles in any direction.
And where a true migratory Canada goose will travel how far?
Well, it all depends on where they call home and where they go to spend their winters in the south or in an area that has a good food source. Now, where we are, our winters aren't that harsh, and the food source is usually available 12 months a year, unless we have a real harsh winter, which a migratory flock, if they come to New Jersey, say from up in Canada, the Arctic Circle, that area, if it becomes a problem, you know, nature kicks in and they head a little bit further south where the grass is exposed from underneath the snow that's not covering it. And the ponds are not frozen over as well, because that's really their safe haven, is being in the water if they're ever attacked on land by a predator-like animal.
Now, years and years ago, decades ago, going back maybe 100 years, there was no such thing as resident geese, right?
Not in this country, there wasn't. The research and data I've looked at, you know, the populations really started to decrease in the 80s and 90s, and it's estimated now that the population in this country grows at a rate of between 10 and 15% annually.
And you and I did have a brief chat the other day, and I did some further research, and it is indeed true that right around 1930, the practice of hunters using captive geese as decoys to lure geese down to a waterway for hunting was outlawed, and the hunters simply released their captive geese, but they had been around for so many generations, they had lost the migratory instinct.
Yes, well, especially if they're introduced to an area that has a food source available to them 12 months a year, they're going to stay. I mean, the problem with geese is that they're a very intelligent animal. People don't give them enough credit, but they are by nature lazy. And when they get a nice, comfortable area where they're not threatened by a natural predator, which is the Arctic fox, they're going to stay. And they're going to take up residence. They're going to nest. They're going to roost. They're going to feed. And that's where they're going to hang out.
And this is a problem largely because the size of a goose and the legendary transportation of food from the mouth of a goose down to the grass on the ground.
Yes. You know, the average adult goose, healthy adult goose, can produce about 1 to 2 pounds of droppings per day. Now, if you have a flock of just, say, 20, 30 geese on your property, an average size flock, I mean, just on how many pounds of goose droppings are going to be left behind on a daily basis. Plus, they're tearing all the grass up, which is their food source, up by the roots, and their droppings, once they get absorbed into the ground, they make the soil very acidic. Now you're going to have very hardened type of back in their spot instead of nice fertilized grass, which is what the kind of goose loves.
So it's not like the herds of bison that would roam and eat some grassland and it would regenerate and their poop would fertilize it. It's just a negative all around.
It is a negative. And, you know, like we discussed the other day, you know, geese have the top five feeding spots. And their first spot, they'll spend about 80-90% of their time there. Their secondary, third, fourth, fifth spots are going to be all divided up, kind of like in a pecking order. So if they experience trouble or development or predator-like animal that's attacking them or their offspring, they're going to move to their second, third, fourth, or fifth spots, which are going to be much safer for them. And that's where they'll set up shop, and then the whole thing repeats itself.
So the same gaggle of geese could cause problems for 3, 4, maybe 5 different properties?
At some level, it's typically the primary spot that they're spending most of their time at is going to be the major issue with homeowners, people that enjoy parks, athletic fields, corporate campuses, HOAs, things along those lines. That's where the problems occur, and that's where we come in and use a very humane method with our border collies, which are highly trained, and our dog handlers. We send a message that they're no longer welcome here. You know, they think they're being attacked by an Arctic fox, which the border collie mimics in many of its ways and size and look and everything to the Canada goose. That triggers the inherent predatory response in the animal, and they move on.
One of the reasons, obviously, that you're on the show now is there has been a lot of talk about wild birds spreading avian flu through their droppings. But you reminded me that Canada geese were a human health problem long before bird flu came along.
Well, there's never been any documented cases of different types of parasites and bacteria that are found in some goose droppings that has human to bird transmission. I've never seen a case of that documented, but I guess there is a potential health issue there. And as we discussed, we're hired by food processing plants, places that produce certain types of food products, or whether it's vitamins or whatever. They hire us because their workers will go out during their breaks to areas where maybe geese are, they're even feeding them, they'll step in these droppings and they'll vector it back into the building. And then if the Board of Health comes in and does some testing, they find that maybe there's some Giardia or E. coli or something, you know, inside that plant. And, you know, there's heavy fines that come along with that.
And that should be a warning, because these geese are so prevalent in many parts of the country that if you do step in goose poop, take your shoes off when you get home. Don't walk into the house with them.
Well, don't do that. Don't go in your car with them. Don't walk in other people's houses. You know, golf courses, which is one of our client bases, you know, these golfers will be stepping in all day. They'll get on the golf course, then they'll walk into the clubhouse, back in the locker room, in the restrooms, and it's called vectoring. They'll vector that stuff all over the place. Now, like I said, there's never been any documentation that it has spread to human disease or affected humans in that way, but I guess there is a potential.
Well, you know, you can get E. coli and Giardia from so many different places, there's almost no need to test. All right.
Right.
So we got a goose problem. We have a big athletic field. It's nice and open. You can see it from the sky. Geese have decided to build their own housing development there. So you get the call. What do you do?
Well, first thing we do is we discuss the issue with the client over the phone. We schedule what's called a site visit. We go out there. We want to meet with the person who is the decision maker or the person that's getting all the phone calls, say, from the parents or the community about the droppings and little Johnny or little Susie, you know, tracking that stuff home every day or getting a cut on their knee and sliding it during a soccer game or whatever it may be, right? We go out, we look at the property, we assess the type of droppings, whether they're old, whether they're a week old, whether they're brand new, whether there's piles of them. We'll assess the whole property. And then it goes into a formula that we've developed over the years that how we do our pricing and cost analysis is based on how far it is from our home office, how far it is from our other clients that are on contract, and how long is it going to take us to get these geese off the property, up and out of there, and how many times a day initially in the initial clearing phase, which we estimate to be anywhere from 4 to 12 weeks, but we normally get them out of there in a week or two. And then we provide them with a proposal.
Now, I think a lot of people have heard about using border collies to chase the geese away. I had this misinformation in my mind that it was like the herds of goats that they use to get rid of invasive plants. You just work
right.
One dog at a time.
One dog at a time. They're independent workers. We found out that very early. I discovered that. If I had two really strong, driven working dogs, one would always shut down and just follow me around as I was giving either the hand or arm signals, depending on how far the dog was from me or across a big lake, or my whistle or voice commands. The dog would sit there and watch the other dog work. So we found that it's most effective with the use of one border collie per dog handler when they go out and they visit our clients.
Let's talk about what does work. You make a contract with this business or college or golf course. You show up then randomly and let the dog run around for a while?
Well, we'll show up. We set them up on a schedule. We do two visits during their morning and their mid to late afternoon feeding times. But we do show up at different times, and we always ask our clients to be our eyes and ears on site because we can't be there, you know, 12 hours a day just sitting there waiting for geese to show up. We also have free on-call service that allows the client to text or call us, and we get out there usually within an hour to maintain a virtually goose-free environment. But we're there at different times during their feeding patterns first, the morning and late to mid-afternoon. At different times, because like I said, these geese are smart, and we push them off, so now they got to go eat somewhere else. They got to find another safe place for them to feed, and that drives them to go to another area that's safe in their minds and not come back to the area where they're being threatened.
Now, there are laws here, even though the resident geese are no longer migratory, they're still protected under
right.
the International Migratory Bird Act.
Yes.
So you have to be very cautious about how you handle their dispersal, right?
Yeah, we're humane. We're the humane solution. You know, when they lay eggs in the springtime, we have to instruct our clients to go to U.S. Fish and Wildlife, apply for the egg addling permits or nest removal permits. They're considered the landowner, in quotes, and we're considered either the agent or sub-permittee of that landowner to act on their behalf to do the egg addling or to do the nest removal.
Right, and the egg addling is shaking the egg so that nothing hatches out of it.
Yeah, so you break the yolk up. But you can't addle eggs too soon. Nature kicks in. The mother realizes that she had a bad clutch, and she'll lay another clutch. So we always wait a minimum of 7 days after we flag a nest.
And this is nothing a homeowner is allowed to do or should do on their own without the correct permits.
Yeah, they are protected species by the Migratory Bird Act of 1918, which is 107 years old. And there's thousands of species of birds on there. It just doesn't protect the Canada goose and all its subspecies. It protects a myriad of birds.
So you come out twice a day, maybe a little bit more than twice a day for several weeks. What are the odds that the geese are going to disappear and just not come back after a point?
Well, we've done a study. It's actually posted on our website. And with each exposure to our methods and our dogs, it becomes exponential over time, where if you chase them one day, then it'll be 2 days before they come back, and then 4 days, eight, and eventually they throw in the towel. They'll test you. The geese, like I said, they're lazy. They don't want to go anywhere else. They like that spot. They may have been there for 10 years raising their young. Then we eventually snap that generational chain, don't let them nest there, and they have to move on. But we did this in-house study early on when I first started this company, just to see how these geese reacted to us and how our methods were working so we could fine tune them. And you know, that's why we follow the model that we use with a minimum of 2 visits in the initial clearing phase from 4 to 12 weeks. I'd say we always can take care of the problem within a week or two, but that's dependent on the landscape. I mean, you might have a 300-acre lake, which have a lot of geese that are coming in there. A lot of different flocks, resident flocks, are using that, you know, as an area to either nest or feed or whatever. So we've got to hit them, you know, a lot. That takes a lot of time. That will take you 8 to 12 weeks to get that problem under control. But normally the simple ponds, the simple lakes, the parks, we usually get that problem under control within the first 1 to 2 to 4 weeks. And then we just maintain a zero goose environment.
And is this going to be a reoccurring problem most of the time, where the following year the pattern will repeat itself?
Well, listen, you're dealing with nature here. So it's not like you cut your grass one time and expect it not to grow the rest of the summer. We have a maintenance program that's very cost effective. People usually spend more money in landscape, you know, repair with pollution control in their bodies of water. There's liability issues. People have slipped that stuff when they step on those fresh goose droppings on concrete or asphalt. It's like ice. They go flying. We've heard of people breaking their backs, their elbows. You know, there's a liability that goes along with it. So it is a safety issue as well. So, that you know, it's, I guess, multifactorial, the problems that these geese do. And plus, you know, this time of year, we get hired by corporations that have geese either close to their entrances or exits because they like to nest where they get a blast of warm air out of the building. But once that nest is built, the father will protect the mother and her clutch of eggs like you can't believe. They're very loyal animals, and they'll attack the employees or the customers who are going in and out of there.
I have done farm work in the past, and geese are large, and they can be very aggressive.
They are. They can hurt you. They're about 20, 25 pounds, and they can put a hurting on you, those geese.
You don't want geese chasing your customers away.
Well, right.
Now, you have how many franchises around the country? People who each have a van and a dog and go out and respond locally?
Yeah, we have 16 offices now in 12 states. Most of them have at least 2 to 4 dogs, multiple vehicles, employees, part-time, full-time. They aren't employees of ours. They run their own businesses just under our rules and regulations and our help, our technical support, our training, anything else they need. We're there for them 7 days a week. So,
and I was shocked to hear that New York City hires you to keep the geese from becoming a problem in Central Park.
Yeah, Central Park, multi-year contract. They love us. And also United Nations campus in Manhattan. Usually urban settings, other than their parks, really don't have a lot of low-hanging fruit from a business standpoint for us. But Central Park, you know, we brought back a really nice balance of nature up there as per our North Jersey franchise owner that has the contract with New York City Parks.
Again, I believe you're even endorsed by the Humane Association?
Animal Humane Society, PETA, the Coalition to Prevent the Destruction of the Canada Goose, they endorse our humane methods. Because don't forget, the federal government will come in and round up geese at a cost with the proper permits in June, and they call it euthanasia. I'm an animal lover. I don't view that as euthanasia. Their methods, I mean, you can go on any of those, like PETA's website, there's videos of how they do it. You know, it's really a bad look for communities or businesses to do that. And it's becoming less and less popular over the years that I've seen, because the community, there's such an uproar when they do that to these beautiful animals. You know, we have a solution that can move them on to areas that really aren't affecting people. We keep them moving.
I guess that would be the ideal goal, to get them out of public places and
right.
into areas where people aren't stepping on it. They're not being attacked.
Right. Yeah, it doesn't impact the public as much.
Because one thing animal lovers have to realize is, no matter how much they enjoy looking at deer or looking at geese, and for God's sake, I don't care how much you love them, don't feed
right.
deer, don't
no.
feed geese. They don't need your help, and you're just being a nuisance. But the numbers have gotten out of control, and at least in your situation, it sounds like you can get them away from the areas they pose the most harm to humans.
Oh, 100%. And it's why we're so successful. You know, we take this very seriously. We're very unique in our methods and what we do. We want to be humane, and we want to be effective for our clients.
And I had to laugh when I spoke to you yesterday. I asked a question. You said, oh, yeah, that there are associated companies you work with, who come out with super pooper scoopers and clean up the mess after. And I said, it's like the guy at the end of the circus with the trash can and the broom following the elephants out to the train, right?
That's right. We try to get him. We have one guy that we refer business to, if the client wants that. A lot of time the clients will hire us and they don't want to incur that extra cost. But I don't think the extra cost to do that is very much. But we try to get him to come out before our first scheduled visit under contract, just so they can see what it was before our service and what it's going to be now with our service. You know, you go from a real dirty circus floor from the elephants and animals to a pristine, finely raked area. So,
it's great. One thing I think you and I both want to remind people, we're talking about border collies, a very specific breed. People fall in love with them instantly, but they are working dogs. They need a job. They're not lap dogs. They're not sitting around the apartment dogs. They are bred to work, and they are desperately unhappy if they don't have anything to herd. So
it's true.
This is stimulating to them, but don't adopt them because you fall in love with them, because you're not going to be able to handle them. Their energy level is above that of almost any human.
Yeah, I was talking to a border collie owner and trainer in agility and what's called flyball at the Philadelphia Dog Show back in the 90s, when we were exploring on a dog for my kids who wanted a dog desperately. And we really took our time. I remember I went up to this dog handler and owner of this border collie that just won this agility contest. And I stopped her and started talking to her. And I said, what do you think about a border collie as our first dog? She stopped immediately. She kind of had a scowl on her face. She goes, you want to get a border collie as your first dog for your young family? Because my two kids are right there with us. And they were probably, you know, 4 and 7 at the time. She looks at me and she says, owning a border collie as your first dog is like getting a Ferrari when you're 17. You have no idea what you're getting yourself into. And then she just took off. So you have to know what you got to get yourself into. These dogs need mental, physical, and emotional stimulation every day. They need a purpose, and they're going to hold you to it. If you're not going to do it, you're 99 things out of 100 things that a border collie finds to do when you're not around, you're not going to like.
Oh, no, they're going to eat your couch. Absolutely, they're going
to eat your couch. Through walls to get out of the house, you know?
So, once again, one of the things I like about your solution, it is a real problem. We have to be careful, especially now with the avian diseases on the rise. But you're making the dogs happy, too, which is a really 100%. Nice closed circle.
Border Collie people love us because we do provide a job, a working environment for them. That alone, they love us, so we give these dogs purpose. Because, you know, how many farms are even out there that are going to have a dog herding sheep or cattle or working on the farm and doing a job? Not many anymore, you know? So the percentage of Border Collie owners in this country is huge. They're a very popular breed, but a lot of them end up in rescues, and it's a shame for that animal. They're such beautiful, smart animals, but you have to understand what you're getting yourself into.
And we have been speaking to Bob Young, the founder and CEO of Geese Chasers, that has offices in many parts of the country. So the problem is not impossible, and you get to make the doggies happy at the same time. It's a win-win.
Yeah. It's been a pleasure, Mike. Thank you so much.
The pleasure's been ours. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Take care.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and remind everybody experiencing wild spring weather and itchy growing fingers that while lettuce, peas, spinach, and other cool weather crops love growing in cold weather, the ground has to be warm enough to sprout their seeds. That's why many of us buy started plants now and sow successions of seeds later when the soil has warmed up. But don't go shopping for spinach just yet, because we'll be right back with important information about caring for your spring bulbs and more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from WDIY-FM in Bethlehem, PA. Why don't spring bulbs freeze to death? Can Venus flytraps overeat? And can a potato really charge your cell phone? I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden, we'll discuss the superpowers of plants. Plus the question of the week and your fabulous phone calls. That's on the next You Bet Your Garden. Welcome back to another thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden from the studios of WDIY-FM in Bethlehem, PA. I am your host, Mike McGrath, and we are in the stretch now, cats and kittens. In just a little bit, I will explain how you can take a crowded bed of spring bulbs, dig them up, and spread them around. But you got to do it right, and you got to do it at the right time of year. We will also cover lots more about spring bulb care if you want those flowers to return, and we know you do. But before that, a fabulous phone call at 610-694-8100. Tom, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thanks, Mike.
Well, thank you, Tom. How you doing, man?
Really well, really well. How are you? I know your health has had some issues.
Oh, yeah. Well, don't get old, people. It's a warning. It's a trap. Actually feeling much better. Thank you for asking. Where is Tom located?
I'm in Durham, North Carolina. You know, we're in Zone 7. I guess my question is more general in nature than pertaining to my garden. I've seen information about biochar / terra preta, which is like an Amazonian soil. And I'm wondering, you know, if you've looked into it at all. I saw some stuff come out of Cornell that seems to say that it would be pretty interesting as a soil amendment.
Well, you know, this is fascinating. I haven't heard anybody mention biochar for a long time. It was a craze between 5 and 10 years ago. And allegedly, biochar, which is burnt wood, charcoal, was found underneath, so to speak, the growing beds in some ancient Aztec civilizations, and people picked up on it from there. If you're like me and you have a wood stove, for instance, and you use it during power failures in the winter, when you clean it out, there's always that one log that didn't turn to powder. And if you want to experiment with biochar, there you go. But I don't see the benefit, especially because its nutrients are lost. They went up in the flames. But I'm not sure how it would help underground, where it would be protected, so to speak, from oxygen and not be very reactive. Now, have you played around with it at all, or you're just bored and looking for something new to do?
Well, yeah, it looks like an interesting project to me. And some of the stuff I've seen on YouTube talked about a guy who was using hardwood charcoal that you'd use for grilling and impregnating it with water and compost, basically compost tea, as a way to make the charcoal a substrate for additional nutrients, which looked interesting to me.
So
I'm thinking this would be a good thing to do in a bed.
So he's using the naturally occurring holes and crevices in the charcoal to hold nutrients, kind of like perlite does as it loosens the soil in a raised bed garden. I would caution people not to use it in their soil. You never want to put any kind of wood product or dry brown material like leaves incorporated in your soil. But, you know, we're kind of dancing around a technique that I have been using for the past couple years called Hugel culture, which is a discipline of permaculture. And because I live in the woods, there's always rotting limbs and branches and stuff littering the ground. It's material, right? It's active material. It's got biomass. There's got to be a good use for it. And the people who developed Hugel culture found that if you especially choose the really softest of the woods and you make a layer underneath your raised bed soil, that wood, because it's already half rotten, that's going to continue to deteriorate and eventually become food for your plants slowly over time. And if you're like me and you have taller and taller raised beds every year, it's a great way to use up the space beyond the root zone of the plants. So it's almost like slow-release fertilizer. But I would love to hear from people who've actually utilized it, because you haven't done anything with it yet, right?
No.
Yeah.
Let me give it a try.
And you mentioned hardwood charcoal. You know, because one of the big trends also around that time was using wood to grill. You know, you would get the high heat off the, not fresh wood, it would be weathered wood, it would be ready to use, but you'd end up with charcoal in the bottom. And this was at Rodale, and nothing ever got thrown away. I mean, there was no way.
Sure.
So people would try it. But if you're going to, quote, buy charcoal or anything like that, you'd have to get it at a place like Whole Foods where it wouldn't be impregnated with chemicals or anything like that. But what do you grow mostly?
Tomatoes, peppers, you know, the kind of the classics. So I've got a little bit of time yet to play around with something.
Yeah, I would suggest if you want to have fun and do some citizen science, make some biochar. You know, I like the idea if you have a grill that can accommodate hardwood grilling, there's nothing like it, man. It's better than gas. It's better than charcoal. And then you'd get your own charcoal from it and plant two Amish paste tomatoes, one with that underneath the root zone and one without. And
yeah, there you go.
Do that with a couple of your plants and take notes and call us back at the end of the season. You may rejuvenate interest in biochar.
Great. That'd be awesome.
All right, man.
All right. Thanks a lot, Mike. I really appreciate it.
Pleasure talking to you. Thank you. Bye-bye.
You too. Bye-bye.
As promised, it is time for the question of the week. How to store, divide, and force spring bulbs. We begin with Michael in Northern Virginia, near Washington, D.C., who writes, can I divide my spring bulbs? Is after the blooms have faded the best time? Thanks, and stay safe from the evil squirrels. Well, evil is too nice a word for those long-tailed servants of Satan, Michael. They've already planted their leftover black walnuts in my container-grown lettuce. Anyway, I've never even thought about dividing my spring bulbs. I just let them grow, and I really like the way they look in clumps. But if divide you wish, do not do it right after the flowers fade. Instead, clip off any seed heads that form after those flowers fade, and then be patient. Before you dig them up, you must wait until the green leaves have turned yellow or brown, the signal that they have received enough solar energy to grow the following year's flower inside each bulb. Dig them up while the leaves are still green, and you won't get no flowers next spring. Once all that green is gone, you can carefully dig them up. Gently remove the browned out leaves if they fall off naturally, but if they don't, just leave them be. Don't cut them off. You can replant the bulbs immediately if their new area is not going to be artificially watered over the summer. But if you'll be watering that area heavily, I suggest storing the bulbs inside for replanting in the fall. Storage. Do not wash them, ever. Do not cut any remaining leaves off. Even brown, those leaves will naturally keep moisture in the bulb. Then wrap each bulb in newspaper or surround the whole bunch with slightly moist milled peat moss and store them in a cool, dry, mouse-proof container until Halloween. After trick-or-treat is over, take the bulbs out of storage and discard any that feel soft or show signs of rot. Then plant the good ones in their new locations between Halloween and Thanksgiving. Don't feed them when you replant them in the fall. Remember, the next flower is already formed inside because you let the green leaves do that work earlier in the year. If you want to feed your spring bulbs, the time to do so is right after their flowers fade in the spring to make sure that the next flowers-to-be get all the nutrition they need. If you find any little bulblets growing alongside a main bulb, gently remove them and plant them somewhere they can be left alone. With any luck, they'll flower in a couple of years. If you allow their green leaves to turn brown naturally, that's the cardinal rule of successful bulb growing. Arabella in the Kyushu Prefecture of Japan writes, last summer I bought tulip bulbs, refrigerated them for a few months, planted them in the fall, and now they are blooming. I have read your wonderful stories of how you have tulips that are teenagers. I will follow those instructions. But if I dig up the bulbs and put them in the refrigerator again, will they rebloom? Or must I first allow their leaves to turn brown naturally for them to produce next year's flowers? Well, Kyushu is the southernmost of the four main islands that make up Japan. The name means nine provinces and is home to 14 million people on 14,000 square miles. The entire island is identified as being subtropical, very different than the dry heat in the summer and freezing cold in the winter climate in which tulips and other spring bulbs originated and thrive. In addition, the island gets 63 inches of rain a year, which is substantial. Spring bulbs prefer a dry summer. And it may not get cold enough in the winter to successfully chill bulbs in the ground in her region. And all that rain could rot the bulbs if they were left in the ground year-round. So yeah, wait until the leaves lose their green color and carefully dig them up. Allow them to dry off naturally under the breeze of a fan for a week or so to get rid of any excess moisture. And then, just as gardeners do in warm climates like the American South, chilling is a good idea. Store the freshly harvested bulbs in a cool, dry area for a short period of time, and then place them in the fridge 16 weeks before you intend to plant them back outdoors in the fall. Essential, that fridge must not contain any fruit or the bulbs could sprout prematurely. Oh, and for the record, those red tulips off to the side of my raised beds are middle-aged now, not teenagers. They were already blooming when we moved in 40 years ago. And finally, Kate in New Haven writes, I was hoping I could plant bulbs in my raised bed in a community garden, but the catalog I was going to order them from advises against raised beds for bulbs. The stated reasons are poor drainage and temperature fluctuations. Stuff and nonsense. Raised beds always drain better than flat ground. And the cold winters in New Haven are perfect for keeping spring bulbs happy and productive. Just be sure that their area is mulched with an inch or two of well-shredded leaves over the winter to prevent any heaving caused by those temperature fluctuations. Plan to run this fall, and next spring will reveal the reward. Well, that was hopefully some helpful advice about getting your spring bulbs to rebloom now, wasn't it? Luckily, you can read those details over at your leisure or your leisure by following the link for the question of the week at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. Yikes, my producer is threatening to spread some goose attractant on my garden if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime, 610-694-8100. That's 610-694-8100, extension number 3. Or send us your email, you're tired, you're poor, you're wretched refuse, teeming towards our garden shore at our new email site, youbetyourgarden1@gmail.com. Either way, please include your location. You'll find our new phone number, our new Gmail address, a link to that all-important question of the week, and new and improved links to our podcast sites, all at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. You Bet Your Garden is a public radio show and podcast produced and delivered to you every week from the studios of NPR station WDIY in Bethlehem, PA. You Bet Your Garden was created by Mike McGrath. Mike McGrath was created when he was banished from Mount Olympus for putting a whoopee cushion on Zeus's chair. Our musical director is Ken Queter. Our social media director is Amanda Norfleet. Our peerless prince of profound production is James Ziprote. Margaret McConnell is the executive director of WDIY-FM. Our executive producer is the always lovely Jonas Bowen. And our incredible assistant is the awesome Ninja Sean. We want to thank our special guest, Bob Young, founder and CEO of Geese Chasers, for being on the show with us today. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and I'll be keeping a close eye on my baby seedlings and encouraging my lettuce and peas to grow faster until I can see you again next week.